The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9,
it is Saturday, the 8th of August in the glorious future year of 2026, which means that yesterday was my birthday. Happy birthday to me. Sorry I didn't do a show.
This is Publius.
I've had things
bringing
I wanted
you
to do, but I haven't actually got around to them.
A step farther out.
I was very much thinking, oh, I should
your
go
weekly radio message from the Man and Atom
and
Society.
See if I can find some small, medium-sized Corningware baking dishes. And what do I want medium-sized Corningware baking dishes for? You may well ask. The answer is metallurgical purposes. Since I need to heat up old coins in a metallurgical furnace, which will probably result in them becoming oxidized, I got to heat them up, let them cool down, then add chemicals to them to clean them. And Corningware is the ideal thing for this, because you can plunge it into boiling lead and then into liquid nitrogen, and it's just fine. It's practically indestructible. It's been successfully used for, missile nose cone reentry bodies. So, that's my thing. It's basically, I got a piece of advice from Joe Paunessa up in Racine, Wisconsin, that among the various things you can use for cleaning the oxide off of blanks, coining blanks when they come out of the furnace, is, weirdly enough, this chlorine compound they sell as pool shock, swimming pool shock. I'd been planning just to use the weak hydrochloric acid, they call muriatic acid, that they sell in jugs at the pool supply store. But if this powdered stuff dissolved in water works more effectively, by sure, I'll use it. Anyway, what is there to talk about this week? Well, of course, I've described my interest in having my own coining press and coining setup. I don't know if I've ever talked about it on this show. The genesis of this about 15 years ago is not just that I wanted to do coining projects, but also the fact that I hate exercise. It just seems so pointless. And so I said to myself, well, what I need to do is set up something where I can produce something, set up some arrangement where I can produce something using muscular effort. And, on the one hand, of course, I'm not the world's biggest advocate of muscle-powered machinery, as I'm sure you've heard me say many times. But in this case, the idea is to have me do something which provides the muscular effort needed to keep the body in better shape, while simultaneously achieving some result that would not be terribly easy to achieve in any other way, such as small-volume coining projects. Anyway, so when I got home, I said, well, the first thing I need to do is call up this particular there's a shop, amazingly called CDC Products. You'd think it was made just to cater to me. Which, basically, an industrial surplus place also selling parts and supplies for the home and small-scale machinist. Hobby machinists and small-scale machinists. Well, yeah, they closed down at the end of last year. Dag nabbit! Because what I was hoping to do was to go over there and see what they had and then see how I could apply it to the problem that I have. As it is, I'm going to have to look around, see what other industrial surplus and salvage and scrapyard type operations there are here in the Metro Mess. And there are plenty. And then just basically hunt around for bits and bobs that I can use. And that's not great. The thing is, obviously, if I had unlimited funds, I'd get down the McMaster car catalog, you know, and I'd just go through and I'd mark out the things that I need, and then I would do a working drawing for stuff to be made by a machine shop, and that'd be easy. But that's probably $10,000 or $15,000, and I don't have the $10,000 or $15,000. I'm trying to get this in, you know, under $5,000, which is much more challenging, time-consuming, and so on. So I really don't know where I'm going to start. That's just letting you know where I am on this. Also, apparently, the price of nickel alloys, in the U.S. at least, has skyrocketed, which is being blamed for, being blamed on Trump, on the Ukraine war, on, you know, all kinds of factors. The price of nickel has been gyrating wildly in recent years because of, on the one hand, you have the very strong demand for some lithium-ion batteries. On the other hand, you have people opening up new nickel mining projects. And so the question is the demand rising faster or is the supply rising faster? If the demand is rising faster, the prices go through the roof. If the supply is rising faster, the prices go very much downwards. It's a very unstable market situation. Not helped, of course, by the occasional massive fraud. You probably heard about the incident a couple of years ago where somebody had bought, you know, 5,000 tons of nickel or something, and the ingots came and they were like zinc or something that had been painted. It was not nickel at all. Anyway, you know, so there's a lot going on with that. But since for one of my two projects, I plan on using old coins, the prices of those, you know, the prices of silver scrap coins, you know, they vary closely with the market price of silver, but the prices of base metal scrap coins do not. You know, if you've got a bin... which has got everything from, you know, zinc and aluminium coins to steel coins to cupro nickel, pure nickel, bronze, pure copper. And it's all, you know, pick out what you want at $12 a pound or whatever. Then the market price of nickel and copper doesn't directly affect you. Indeed, I've got quite a bit of pure nickel scrap coinage that if somebody was in the market for nickel, the French franc coins in particular, French new 1 franc and then the two franc pieces, you know, it could just be, you know, thrown into the pot. I wouldn't have any problem with that because they're still around in such immense quantities. Anyhow, so I don't have any really clear opinion on the way forward right now. But I'll keep you up to date once I succeed in doing some more. You know, as I say, I got some very good piece of advice on building a coining press from somebody who has sadly now passed away. Just last week, as I say, I visited Joe Paunessa of the Root River Mint in Racine, Wisconsin. Root River Mint is basically his garage workshop, but hey, that's how it goes. Now, he's doing some very interesting things with laser engraving. 15 years ago, when I was looking to get into this, laser engraving in steel to make dies was out of reach. Absolutely out of reach. Now, he's got a setup. He bought secondhand, but it's a setup that cost him about $6,000. And he can make finished dies, which is very impressive. You know, as I said, I always knew this was possible, but the technology has advanced faster, or at least the prices have come down faster, than I was anticipating. I don't know how it is. You know, you look away for 5 years and the whole world has changed. Let's see. Europe continues to suffer under heat waves, and the flow in the Rhine and Danube rivers has dropped. I got an email from another SDFer here, linking me to a news article about nuclear power endangered as Rhine and Danube river flows drop. Now, of course, in Romania, on the Danube, the Cernavoda plant is kind of out of service at the moment, which has had catastrophic effects on Romanian electricity market. Actually, let me see if I can check real time on the Cernavoda plant. Because it is, this Unit 1 had a, Unit 1 was down for, so for some reason IAEA PRIS, they have rearranged something. This is, made it very much harder to use. Why do they have to redo this website? But yeah, Cernavoda, the mouth of the Danube, anyway, they got one unit shut down for normal operation reasons, and the other unit got shut down for, they had a transformer fail or something, one of those non-nuclear things where you can't use the power plant. Let's see. Okay, so Unit 1 at Cernavoda was reconnected to the grid, let's see, okay, on the 5th of July, I guess, 5th or 6th of July. Let's see. So they have, this is fascinating, actually. The Romanian Navy has destroyed a large block of stone that was altering the flow of the Danube River so that there's more flow available. So they'd shut down Unit 1, they'd shut off Unit 1, and then they are, so first they destroyed a blockage on the river in order to arrest the fall of flow to Cernavoda, and then they are also sinking rock-filled barges in another arm of the Danube in order to divert water towards Cernavoda. This is quite fascinating. Um, It has to be emphasized, however, this is not a uniquely nuclear problem. Not in any way, shape, or form. That any thermal power plant is going to have problems, right? Any thermal power plant requires cooling, water supply. There's a lot of fuel burning, particularly coal burning, power plants in Eastern Europe. And without cooling water, they're not going to generate a lot of power. That's just how this works. You've got to have water flow to the condenser. Doesn't matter if it's a nuclear power station or a coal-fired station. At the same time, low flow is particularly bad for hydroelectric power. As a matter of fact, a number of places, including Switzerland, first began to put in nuclear power plants after they had a series of bad hydropower years. Because a nuclear power plant requires a lot less water per megawatt hour than a hydropower plant does, as evidenced by the well-known case that I've talked about before of the Trawsfynydd hydroelectric plant in Wales. The Trawsfynydd nuclear power plant in Wales, which used for cooling the reservoir built for the Maintrog hydroelectric plant. Maintrog was a 25 megawatt hydro plant. Still is, basically. Trawsfynydd, a 500 megawatt nuclear plant. So the lakes could supply 20 times as much power on the nuclear side than on the hydro side. So, you know, hydro is going to be the first affected by low river flows, and then any form of thermal generation. People, I think, get the idea that there's some special danger associated with low river flow at nuclear power plants, right? Thing being, you need shutdown decay heat removal. Shutdown decay heat removal, though, requires about 1%. Right, you're talking about removing about 1% of the amount of heat that is produced by a running reactor. So if you have to shut it down, the amount of water that you need is so much smaller that, firstly, the typical plant has some kind of reservoir which will handle that for 3 or 4 days as a safety measure. But it's the sort of thing where your local municipal water supply system or even a fire truck pumping from the middle channel of, you know, driving out into the dry riverbed, dropping its pickup into the what's left of the stream and pumping it up through a hose can supply that amount of water. You know, so there is, in the extreme case, if all water were to be suddenly removed from the area, a safety concern. But if all water were to be suddenly removed from the area, you'd be talking about a catastrophe that, frankly, nuclear meltdown would be the least of your worries. So yeah, I don't have any real clear... I don't have anything really clear to say about that, I guess. You know, as I say, we are not anything like to the point where decay heat removal becomes a worry, because you're talking about a roughly 1% of the water needed for cooling an operating power plant. The main concern is having to throttle back or shut down completely your thermal power stations and your hydropower stations, leaving you without adequate energy to cope with the system loads. And that is going to have a very serious effect on people. You know, there's a lot of things that you need to do, obviously. But one of them is, if you're having a heat wave, there's going to be a demand for electricity for air conditioning. If you... even if you shut down all the industries for a heat emergency, which you might actually do, because, for example, many factory buildings are not air-conditioned, you're going to have a demand for ice-making, refrigeration, and air-conditioning for office buildings, hotels, high schools, whatever places you're using to evacuate people to keep them from dying of heat stroke. You know, so you need the electricity. Where the electricity is going to come from then becomes a problem. Now, some people say, well, you do solar, and, you know, when it's really hot, solar works well. To some extent? It's not as clear-cut as that. But yeah, so it's not as though the Danube and the Rhine have stopped flowing completely. The problem is that the river levels have dropped well below the levels that anyone is comfortable with them having. Now, one approach that solves this, that a friend of mine likes to advocate for, is to put your nuclear power plant at the bottom of a deep hole at the bottom of a river. His particular point of view has to do with the rivers in Alberta, Calgary and Edmonton specifically being the cities he's thinking of. He says, just put the reactor plant at the bottom of a deep hole, let the water from the river just go down the hole, and then it gets warmed up by the condenser discharge of the power plant, then let it come back up and distribute it to all the, you know, houses and buildings, businesses in the city for heating purposes. Because, of course, most of the year in Calgary and Edmonton, you need heat. And, of course, as I've said many times, the one thing that nobody really talks about a lot, though it does deserve talking about, is heat-activated refrigeration. That you can actually use heat rejected from a thermal power plant to produce refrigeration. Now, the caveat there, as I've said before, is that you have to derate the thermal power plant somewhat. Because you're increasing the condenser temperature or reducing the condenser vacuum, depending on who you talk to. Right, you go from like a 30 degrees C condenser temperature to 100 degrees C or even 120 degrees C condenser temperature. That means a loss of efficiency. But if that 100 degrees C, 120 degrees C condenser water is then used to heat buildings in the heating season, to cool them in the cooling season by the use of the absorption cycle chiller, then even though your power plant efficiency is less, your overall efficiency, the fraction of the energy that goes to paying customers, effectively, is much higher. You go from a maximum of about 40% to a figure that could be closer to 70 to 80% on a year-round average. Now, a little bit of chatter in comm, referring to the fact that one of the advantages which has been posited for what are referred to as small modular reactors is the idea that they can be less sensitive in terms of shutdown cooling requirements. There's actually two ways to do this. And it very much depends on your reactor technology, because even a very large, let's say 1,000 megawatt, 1,500 megawatt, sodium-cooled fast breeder reactor or helium graphite reactor, those can be basically, they don't require water for emergency shutdown cooling. They can be cooled by air, because the temperatures, well, the two reactor types are very different in their thermal characteristics. But the important thing to observe is that the sodium-cooled fast breeder, for example, the top temperature is typically about 500 degrees centigrade. The boiling point of sodium at atmospheric pressure is about 1,000 degrees centigrade, so it really has to heat up before anything bad starts to happen. And that means that you can have a fairly simple passive heat exchanger, basically open up louvers and let air flow around the reactor vessel, which is normally in a concrete pit, right? You have a stainless steel reactor vessel in a concrete pit, and if you have dampers that can open and just let ordinary atmospheric air flow around that reactor vessel, then heat being transferred from, as I say, the rate of heat production is relatively low in the shutdown reactor, can be carried away by normal airflow. The helium graphite reactor, again, can withstand extremely high temperatures because its main material of construction is graphite and it contains nothing chemically reactive. And so, again, the sort of passive heat loss through the walls, even though the walls are insulated, is enough to keep the temperature within safety limits, just because the maximum temperature for the safety limits is very, very high. Now, for water-cooled reactors, it's a bit more difficult because of two phenomena. Firstly, as the temperature increases, the pressure increases very, very rapidly, which can lead to bursting of pressure vessels, which you do not want. And secondly, as the temperature increases, you begin to get runaway chemical reactions, particularly the water zirconium reaction. Below about 350 degrees centigrade, and in liquid water, no matter how hot, zirconium metal alloys are chemically stable. They form a stable oxide coat which protects them from further oxidation. However, zirconium in steam is a completely different situation. Zirconium reacts, you get a runaway oxidation which generates large volumes of hydrogen gas. Hydrogen, of course, not being condensable, leads to a rapid escalation in the pressure inside the pressure vessel, which could, in principle, lead to bursting, which you really do not want, or more likely to an escalation of pressure such as the lid of the pressure vessel lifts off. Essentially, the bolts that hold the pressure vessel head on become too stretched, and some of the gas and steam inside the reactor escapes. And if too much of the steam escapes, why, then the water level will continue falling. You'll get more and more zirconium water reaction, which you do not want. And in water-cooled reactors, this is very much a function of the power density and the size. So something like a CANDU, even a very large CANDU, does not have this problem because the volume of water in direct contact with the fuel elements is relatively small. If that starts to overheat, the zirconium pressure tubes will actually bow and then contact the calandria tubes, and then the much larger volume of heavy water will serve as a heat sink. In a pressurized water reactor or a boiling water reactor, however, basically all you can do is keep the unit size small enough that there's more surface area per unit volume, right? Because power is generated per unit volume, heat is dissipated per unit surface area. And the bigger you get, the square cube law means you have less surface area per unit volume, which means which results in a bigger emergency shutdown cooling problem. Again, it's not something that really comes up in most instances, aside, of course, from the famous Fukushima event, where the water pumps themselves were, for emergency cooling, were put out of service by the earthquake and tsunami. Even in that situation, it's possible to envision passive cooling. Again, if you just build your nuclear power plant offshore so that if anything happens, it can lose heat to the seawater, for example, that's one approach. It is, however, somewhat unattractive because seawater is corrosive and destructive. There were serious plans for offshore nuclear power plants in the U.S., particularly for the East Coast, the Southeast, in the 1970s, but they never came to anything. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. Next week I'll have to tell you about this parcel that Kuma sent me. If you want to encourage me with money and are not happy sending an envelope full of cash, by all means, paypal.me/prometheuslives, patreon.com/man_and_Adam, and coming up is Toad with the Dubious Goals Committee.